This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the days when Chris Matthews grilled politicians and their surrogates on his MSNBC show Hardball, he was a top aide to House Speaker Tip O'Neill, advising him on how to deal with the press. Now Matthews has written a new book called Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. It's about how the Democratic Speaker O'Neill and the Republican president, Reagan, managed to work together and reach compromise in spite of the fact that they disagreed not only on policy but on the role of government. Matthews compares that to today and what he describes as government by tantrum, where, rather than true debate, we get the daily threat of filibuster and shutdowns are engineered as standard procedure. Matthews' first work with Tip O'Neill in 1981 in his role as communications director for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Matthews' job was to help the speaker in his new role as party spokesman. Matthews later became O'Neill's administrative assistant. I spoke with Chris Matthews yesterday before we were certain the government would shut down, but we knew we faced the possibility of the House refusing to raise the debt ceiling in mid-October, which could lead to the U.S. defaulting on its debts. Chris Matthews, welcome to Fresh Air. You tell a story in your book about how Tip O'Neill worked with Ronald Reagan to raise the debt ceiling. First of all, what was the sticking point?
Well, the usual sticking point is nobody gets any points as a member of Congress in either party for raising the debt ceiling. It always strikes people as big spending and debt and creating more debt, when in fact, it's the final stage. It's after the bill has been appropriated, the spending has been approved, and they simply have to pay their bills that they've already rung up. But it sounds like spending, so usually the president's party has to come up with the majority of votes for any kind of debt ceiling extension. In this case, the Democrats had a nominal majority in the House made up of about 40 conservative Democrats from the South. But the president's man, Max Friedersdorfer, who was an excellent congressional liaison, lobbyist, if you will, he came to the speaker and said, we need Democratic votes to get the debt ceiling extended. And the speaker, and this is Max telling the story about the conversation he was in, the speaker said, fine, we'll do it. I just want a letter from the president to each of those members on my side asking them to do it, which will immunize them against partisan attack come the next election. And he said, deal. And the next day they got the letters. And the speaker was so impressed, and this is Max talking, that the fact that, A, he could make such a commitment on his own without the president there, and two, he could deliver. And I think that's the kind of thing that happens if both parties simply want to get through it and they don't want to score points, but they want to do what has to be done.
There was also a budget summit that you write about when President Reagan realized he needed to increase taxes because of the national debt and that Social Security needed to be adjusted. But this was a very politicized issue. And, Democrats and Republicans were going to meet about it. There's a big summit. But The summit was like such a sensitive issue. There was a meeting about what the rules for the summit was going to be and who was going to be invited at the summit, whether aides were going to be involved or not. And I thought, I didn't realize that there were meetings about meetings like this. Can you describe that meeting about what the summit should be like?
Well, I was pretty partisan in those days, to put it lightly.
And you're not now?
I was pretty partisan.
Can you remember
overtly,
that far back to when you were partisan?
I may have leanings now, but I had definitely propensities in those days. Uh-huh. And I wanted to make sure that the speaker didn't get set up. And so I was worried about who was going to be in the meeting. And I wanted to make sure, he certainly did, that there'd be some substance people in the room. And he had a young fellow named Ari Weiss, who was a brilliant guy on numbers and legislation. He relied on him completely. And he wanted to bring him to the meeting. Now, on the other side, Jim Baker, the chief of staff to the president, who was a good chief of staff, maybe the best ever, he said, no staff. So I called him up and I said, the speaker wants to bring Ari. And he said, no staff. And then I said, well, your staff, and you're going to be in the meeting. He didn't like that. And I went back and told the speaker, and he said, well, I'm bringing Ari. And then they brought in Stockman and they brought Don Regan, the Secretary of Treasury and the OMB director, to balance out Ari. But at least there were people in the room who could deal with the numbers. And we thought it was just going to be for show, this summit. The president was willing to walk an extra mile to come up to Capitol Hill. And as you said, it was about a deficit problem, which was rising the year after Reagan took office and got his big tax cuts through, his defense increase and everything. And the deficits were far beyond what they had expected or could defend. And they needed Democrats to sign on to some kind of change in Social Security or whatever. I discovered outside the meeting, staffers for the president were passing the word that the Democrats were the ones who were giving in on Social Security, in fact, urging a cut in Social Security benefits. And I told the speaker when he came out of the room, and he said, okay. And then he went back in the room and he said to the president, are you calling for a cut in Social Security or not? And Reagan said, no, I'm not doing it. It's you guys that are doing it. And then the speaker said, well, I'm not doing it. So they got nowhere in that meeting. But there was good chemistry there, according to Jim Baker. He said that the guys were working together. And before the big election of midterm election of 82, the speaker backed the president in raising taxes to make up for the excessive deficits from the year before. And he went out on the floor of the House and told the Republican members, you're here because of Reagan. You owe him your loyalty. And Reagan said in his diary that day, it was very strange to have Tip on his side on this issue. So this is the pattern. They would fight like brothers, and then they would deal.
So Tip O'Neill, though, set some conditions before getting Democrats to vote for President Reagan's budget. Do you want to explain the conditions?
Yeah, he would. This is what I think might be missing today. And this book is not a catechism, it's history. But it does help to understand the context. In those days, I think these two old guys, they wanted it to work. They had not just their own philosophy driving them, but they had a commitment to the republic, to our form of government. They didn't like stalemates and shutdowns and all this kind of thing that slowed everything down. And they wanted to move ahead. And they also knew the American people needed that for morale. So what the speaker said in 1982 in backing Reagan on what was called TEFRA, the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act, which was the largest tax increase in history, he basically said to Reagan, I want 100 Republicans on this baby because we're going to be raising taxes on corporations and they're not going to like it. I want 100 votes and then we'll give you the rest. We'll give you the most votes, the 118 on top of that. And Reagan went out and scrounged up the 100 votes and they did it. They did the same thing on tax reform later on. In that case, he asked for 50 votes.
So the idea was if you're going to get Democrats to vote for this, there's got to be Republicans taking responsibility to
share the heat
so that you can't pin it on the Democrats.
Yeah. And in that case, you don't want to be known when you have to raise money in election time that you're an enemy of the corporations. And I think it was just share the burden and the kind of negotiation I think goes on between labor and business and anywhere you live in your own contracts where you work. You negotiate. And you haggle a bit, but in the end, you know, the goal is to keep working there. It's not to lose the job or to lose the contract. It's to keep the business. And I think that's what these guys shared.
You worked for Tip O'Neill. You were an aide to him, and you became his communications aide. And you say Tip O'Neill thought that Reagan had the advantage of his good looks and his warm smile,
yeah.
And that O'Neill didn't feel like he was, like, physically attractive, and that bothered him, and he didn't think he was good on television, in part because he didn't have TV looks. How much of an issue was that for him?
Well, as he used to say to me...
And you should describe him, because a lot of our listeners won't remember what
he was. He was a big guy with white hair.
Like.
He had great hair. He had white hair, and he was a big guy, 6'3", strong guy, strong arms. He wasn't just overweight. He was a big guy, and he was overweight, and he felt that. And he used to talk about his cabbage ears and big nose. He was always very sensitive about his appearance. In fact, I always thought he looked great, and I thought the older he got, the more he looked great. And by the way, what's Tip O'Neill supposed to look like? He looked like Tip O'Neill. And Reagan, on the other hand, had the charm and the good looks of Hollywood, and the great Tip would always talk about his physique. He was an athlete who had made his name in the movies by playing a football star. And he did worry about the camera. And he also would say the things to me like, Reagan's voice, that cowboy voice of his, is just unbeatable. He thought Reagan's looks weren't quite as important as that wonderful voice of his, that in the old days of the drive-in movie theater, like Dean Martin, he had one of those voices that just crackled through the speaker into your car. And Reagan had that wonderful voice he used in broadcasting sports in his early career and then later in cowboy movies. And Tip thought that was a challenge for him, to go up against him on television. But he decided he had to do it. He brought me in. I was brought in with the encouragement of some other people back in early 81, and then he made me his administrative assistant with the top job. But my job all along really was to write. He called me his writer, and to encourage him. He wanted somebody in the room to say, come on, let's get on television, because he had a lot of older people around him who said, don't go on.
What was your strategy in trying to make Tip O'Neill more TV-friendly?
Well, I thought this, and it's easier to do it when you're working for somebody than being somebody. I had this idea that the modern press was not the way the press was when he grew up politically. When he grew up politically up in Boston, you fed your friends and you starved your enemies. So you would give all the time in the world to Barnicle and the other people at the Globe and Healy and those guys and Nolan and Tommy Oliphant, Curtis Wilkie, all those famous guys on the bus. And you wouldn't say a word to the Herald. The Herald was a Hearst paper for a while there, and then it was involved with, News Corp. And so you didn't feed them at all because they were the enemy, and they were the enemy of Ted Kennedy, too. So it was very simple. But when you come to Washington and you get on the big national stage, most of the reporters who work for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the front pages, the A-section people, are totally, utterly professional. They're mostly well-educated men and women who try to write the truth. Now, they may have quirks at different times. They may write a column which is tougher on you than you'd like. But generally, they're trying to find the truth and get a smart look or smart angle into what's going on. You can't predict how their day-to-day coverage is going to run. Generally, it'll be objective, but there may be a point of view that it's going to hurt you occasionally. But if you do enough of this is my philosophy. If you do enough of this over a series of months, people get a good picture. It's distillation that matters. People have read 50 different articles about somebody, but they basically get a distillation of what they think of that person. And I thought Tip was a good guy. I think he was a committed liberal, not a phony liberal. He wasn't out to appease interest groups. He cared about the individual, the young poor kid who couldn't go to college, the older person, the person who's ill and needed health care. He cared about those people. So I thought if I could just get that heart of the guy out there, the people would sort of gradually fall in love with the guy, and they would disagree with him on big spending, but he would become a really cult figure for a lot of people.
I'm kind of surprised that you didn't stay in politics after Tip O'Neill left office. You had run for the State House in Pennsylvania.
Actually, I ran for U.S. Congress.
Oh, it was U.S. Congress.
Northeast Philly. I ran for Congress in the 4th Congressional District in a primary, Democratic primary, and I did okay. I got about a quarter of the votes against the machine incumbent. But I didn't
think I'd win
the next
election. Wait, this was 1974,
right.
And you were how old?
28.
Okay, and so
and I wanted to get back,
saying,
and I wanted to get back to Washington, and where I had worked before for Frank Moss from Utah. He took me back. He got me a really great job with the new Senate Budget Committee for 3 years with Muskie, and then I went to the White House. I've always been very lucky to get these positions and to end up where I wanted to go, which is to be a speechwriter for a president. I talk about in the book where I'm riding around in the Rhodesian Railroad, the old Rhodesian Railroad back in 70 in the Peace Corps, where I was working in Swaziland teaching business. And I just wanted to be a speechwriter. I always wanted to be a writer, and in different forms. That takes different forms, like being a columnist, being a speechwriter, very similar. I wanted to write opinion. I just wanted to be Ted Sorensen, my hero, who had worked for Kennedy. I always saw that as my route rather than running for office and having people look at me and cheer me and raise money and do all that stuff. I guess maybe it's an easier route, but it's the one I wanted to take.
What was losing like for you when you lost the congressional primary in 74?
Well, I knew it was an uphill battle. I was hoping that 1974 was the year of Watergate and that anything could have possibly happened. And it did for a lot of people, but not for me. To be honest with you, I knew it made my bones, as they say in the mafia. Because when I came back to Washington, my old boss, Frank Moss, the senator from Utah, really believed in me. He said, you had the nerve to go out and do that. In fact, he had urged me to get into politics. He said, you should dip a little deeper into these political waters. And so I became seen as somewhat of a colleague of these guys for having taken the chance. So it worked for me. I felt good about it. It was a bit of a rite of passage. But, you know, I don't know if I'd stuck in Congress, how long I would have lasted, whether I would have been good at it in constituency politics. I like much better to be able to design my own political message and to focus where I want to focus it on issues of peace and war and race and certainly voter suppression. Lately, I've been against that and not have to argue the usual tray of issues that a party person has to do. I get to select where I want to make my points. And in some areas, I want to let alone because I don't have a strong view on, or I may disagree with a lot of people on my side politically. I don't agree with them. So I focus on where my passions are.
So, as everybody knows, you're the host of Hardball on MSNBC. Now, having advised Tip O'Neill about how to deal with the press and having fed him kind of lively talking points to say to the press, do you feel like you know the tricks that people have when they're politicians or aides to politicians or spinsters when they come on your show?
Yeah, I do. Terry, I know the talking points, and especially when you ignore the question. I do know that, and that bothers me, and I react impulsively, and I try to move them back to the question I asked. I do have one ability with my program, and I don't think you have this manner or this style, which is if somebody dodges a question, I will go back and ask it again. And if I ask
and
it
again and again, yeah.
Well, I can only do it four times maybe at some point. I think on Meet the Press, Tim used to do it two or three, but I could go to four at a point where people say, I just want them to know that you didn't answer the question. Like I had a member of Congress on who was a Tea Party guy the other day, and I said to him—
This is Blake Farenthold?
I think so. It was one of the Southern guys, and I said, was the president—
We got it.
Legitimate.
We got the clip, oh. Chris. We're going to play the clip.
Okay.
Okay, so let me set this up. So you're interviewing Blake Farenthold, who's a Republican congressman from Texas, and you're talking about defending Obamacare and Ted Cruz's fake filibuster. And then you ask Farenthold if he thinks that Ted Cruz would be eligible to run for president since Ted Cruz was born in Canada, but his mother was born in the U.S., even though his father was not born in the U.S. And if Ted Cruz is eligible to run for president, what does that say about Obama and whether Obama was legitimately elected? So here is an excerpt of your interview with Blake Farenthold.
Well, let me ask you about the president. Is he eligible running for president? I've said he is. Do you agree?
I wouldn't be surprised. You look at where some
eligible.
Of his campaigns
No, eligible. No, stick to the point, Congressman. I said I believe he's eligible. He had an American mother. No matter where he was born, you have an American mother. I believe you're a natural-born citizen. Do you agree with that?
Listen, we've had this discussion about President Obama. So
I'm talking about Cruz. Stick to the point, Congressman.
He's as eligible as Obama is.
Well, what does that mean?
Obama's president. Ted Cruz can be president.
What do you mean? Explain terms. This is serious business, Congressman. You're chuckling about this. Is he eligible to be president? You've been touting the guy. He said he could run for president. Explain. Is he eligible? You brought it up. I didn't.
No, I think he's eligible. I'm giving you a yes answer.
So if Obama was born overseas to an American mother, even if that crazy theory of Donald Trump was true, he'd still be eligible to be president by that standard.
Well, listen, we're talking about Ted Cruz. Obama is
Can't you project an inch mentally?
I'm just projecting. I'm telling you that President Obama is the president.
No, you brought this up. Let me, Congressman, is he legitimate? Was he a legitimately elected president of the United States?
I wasn't in Congress to determine that. That was determined before I got here.
Well, when does Congress get to determine whether a president meets the standards of being a natural-born citizen? What would that formulation be? In other words, there's going to be a vote in Congress sometime between now and 2016
when Ted Cruz is legitimate? It's when the Congress accepts the electoral votes.
That's when it would have been timely to raise. And what would you have done?
Listen, I...
Why are you afraid
of this? I wasn't
here. What is in the water down there?
I'm not afraid of it at all.
Say yes or no. Is Barack Obama a natural-born citizen?
I have said Ted Cruz is as eligible to be president as...
This is your problem with your party. It has gotten so far into the wacko bird. What's wrong with saying Barack Obama was a natural-born citizen and therefore eligible to be president? Why can't you say that?
President Obama is president. What else is there to say than that? We're nitpicking over words here.
No, because you are playing a game once again of trying to somehow make him not quite the president. Yeah, he got into the office. You're admitting that. But he didn't do it legitimately, did he? Just say he did.
He's president. He's president. What more is there to say?
Why are you having a problem? Okay, can you repeat after me? He was legitimately elected president.
President Obama was elected president.
Legitimately.
The people elected him. Yes.
Legitimate. So he was a natural born citizen.
I didn't make that judgment when he was brought in.
Okay. Well, everybody watching knows what you're doing. You're dodgeballing.
Wow, a Chris Matthews moment.
I don't create these moments, Terry. I just smell them. When these guys start dodging, that's one talent I've nurtured. If somebody's dodging the answer, why don't they just say, because it's not that he doesn't believe it. I will project here. He has 5 or 10% of people in his constituency who will never forgive him if he says President Obama is a legitimately elected president of the United States. They still hold to that birther thing out there, which is it's awful.
So listening back to that clip with Republican Congressman from Texas, Blake Farenthold, what was your take on that excerpt and on what it did or didn't accomplish?
Well, what it accomplished was to show that this fellow had a problem with the words legitimately elected president. And he hadn't come to peace with the interesting parallel between Ted Cruz being born overseas to an American mother, which I believe makes him a natural-born citizen, and the charge made against President Obama forever and still sits out there, that he was born to an American mother. Nobody challenges that, but he was born in Kenya or Indonesia, and therefore he's not a natural-born citizen, therefore not legitimately elected. They don't see the contradiction in their easy acceptance of Ted Cruz's background, which I share an acceptance of. I believe he's naturally born American. And the fact that at their worst-case scenario, President Obama has pulled some con, as Donald Trump would say, on the American people, that he was in fact born in Kenya or somewhere else and claims to be naturally born through some manipulation of the Hawaiian press back in 1961 or two. And so I just was trying to get to that, and I think I got there.
So some people are very critical of you and your interview style and call you like a blowhard. And
Not lately.
Okay. And other people just like applaud you for like he doesn't let anybody get away with anything. He hammers them until they give an answer or demonstrate that they're unwilling to give an answer. What's your kind of self-critique of your style?
Well, I was talking to my brother the other day up in New Jersey, and he's a Republican office, so he held office for years, and he said, my Republican friends like it when you, even if you go after a Republican, they like it when you press for an answer. They consider that hardball. They want that to be the nature of the show. And it is at its best. I mean, when I've gotten Zell Miller to want to have a duel with me and some of the stranger things that Michelle Bachmann has said on the air about wanting to have a kind of a McCarthyite investigation of the Congress, those people do it under pressure. I'm sure they walk away saying, how did I get buffaloed into that? Because if you listen carefully, Ed McMahon, of all people, said the key to an interview is to listen to the last answer. And if you hear in the last answer equivocation, well, I go for it. I'm heat-seeking. And I think that's what I do. And I don't think it's everyone's taste. I think on Sunday mornings, for example, Meet the Press, that audience may be different. I know that when people come looking for me at 7 o'clock at night Eastern time, they want that. And it's their way of seeing that I'm not on the side of the person, or I'm not caballing with the person who's on the program, but trying to work for the audience.
On election night in 2010, you interviewed Michelle Bachmann. And no matter what you asked her, she kept giving four of the same talking points. And you finally said to her, are you hypnotized? You keep saying the same thing over
because
and over.
Obviously, she's a very attractive person, and she was very winning with the crowd for a while. And she did have a lot of spunk, if you will, a lot of energy and excitement about what she believed. But when I asked her questions, she just kept giving that actually robotic answer. And I suppose it was disrespectful of a public official to say, are you hypnotized? Because it didn't seem to bother her to be giving an answer. In fact, I saw a congressman doing that about 9 months ago. He's been told by his media people, just give the same answer over and over again and you'll be okay. And that's not true. People can tell if you give it over and over again. It's not really true. I remember watching a wonderful film, again, a movie reference to Lives of Others, where the Stasi guy said they listened to these interviews and these interrogations over and over again.
This is a film set in East Germany, and everybody's being spied on by the government and by their neighbors. Yeah.
And if he said it, they give the exact verbatim explanation of something again and again, you know they're lying because they have to give a verbatim answer that's always exactly the same. They can't let their mind wander and give it a different way because it didn't happen. It's so interesting. I've tried to remember that. So if they give me a robotic answer, I know that they haven't really considered it as a truth or something they believe. It's simply something they're repeating.
When I said before that some people think of you as a blowhard, you said, not lately. So,
well, it's all a question of
timing. Do you think people have changed or you've changed if it's true that people don't think of you as a blowhard now?
Well, I think people have their own styles. As I said, there's the Sunday morning audience, and then there's the cable audience. And I think that, you do it very well, obviously, Terry. I mean, reducing the length of your question is a good thing to do. Try to find an economy of language so that you can ask a three-word question and get a long answer. That's very good. Learning how to cue people. But also to race them a little. Get them working a little faster than they like to think out loud. So they begin to think just on their feet, and they have to answer it more impulsively. And that way you can get closer to the truth. And I know it has an aspect of the interrogation room of Sipowicz or somebody interrogating a guy. But it's I'm telling you, if you really want the truth, you can't just let them come in and and bogart it and just keep giving long answers and thank you for the mic, I'm not going to talk for 10 minutes, which some people on either side of the aisle do that. They come on and say, thank you for that question, which I now will ignore, and I will give you the speech. And it drives me crazy because I can't interrupt them. And then when you do say, please, or interrupt, they go, would you let me finish? And what they want to do then is give another speech totally unrelated to your question. And it is a question and answer format.
You had been on at 5 o'clock with a rerun of your show at 7. Now you just have the 7 o'clock time. What happened?
Well, they want to try to have, I think, Phil Griffin, the head of my network. In fact, this doesn't take a lot of conjecture, wants the numbers to go up every hour. And as long as I was on twice in the same three-hour period, a lot of people were watching me at 5 and not watching me again at 7. And so he wants to build every hour. So we go on at 7 every night. And, for total audience, of course, I'd like to have both hours. But in terms of the rating, the audience you draw in that hour, I think it's proving to be very successful in coming in between 7 and 8. Of course, we all on television want to be on all the time. But, I think 7's fine. And I think it's good because I always say that in the early part of the evening, you want to ingest as well as digest. So people are coming home from work on the East Coast or an hour earlier in the central time zone. But they're coming home, and they want to sit down and relax a bit, maybe before dinner or during dinner, and they want to learn in a rich way what happened that day of political consequence. But then they want to learn a little of the analysis and the point of view that it's brought out. Later in the evening, it's much tougher to do a program like Rachel Maddow does, where you have to go almost to the back of the book immediately, and you have to do a very enriching kind of discussion about a policy question or something that's come up. And it becomes much more challenging to come up with a totally novel discussion, whereas I have the benefit of bringing the news. And bringing the news at that time of night when people just want to know what happened is much more favorable to me, and it's what I want to do, which is grab the news, say what I think of it, and then have some arguments about it. And that usually sharpens it. Martin Nagransky, who started this whole thing of talk television years ago, and Nagransky and Company, told me the purpose of his program, and it's the purpose of all of our programs, is to sharpen the issue so that after you've watched the show, you know what the fight's about.
You're Catholic. You went to Catholic schools. You went to Holy Cross College. And you love movies, like all of your viewers know. You're always kind of recasting actors as the politicians you talk to. And
I know.
But anyways, did you grow up with a problem of not being able to see movies you wanted to see because they were on the Catholic Do Not Watch list?
No. I think for some reason my mom didn't want us watching Donna Reed of all shows.
Donna Reed?
But, yeah, I know. And she didn't want us watching
the... Oh, what a wholesome show.
I know.
What was her problem
with Donna
Reed?
We weren't allowed to watch The Untouchables.
Well, they had machine guns. Donna Reed didn't have machine guns.
But we were allowed to watch monster movies late at night. I don't know. No, I've always seen... My dad used to take us to the films when mom didn't want to go. I had a bunch of brothers, four brothers. So we'd always go to a drive-in for $1 and we'd all fall asleep in the car and dad would drive us home after the Midnight Spook show and all the cartoons and all the double features. And I just grew up loving the movies. And Kathy and I go all the time and we've seen all the good movies this year. And I see things in life that remind me of something I've seen in a movie over and over and again. I don't know why that is.
So I want to ask you about a controversial policy now at CNN. The show Crossfire has been restarted, and that's the show where there's somebody from the right and somebody from the left, and they go at each other and disagree on the issues. And one of the people on the right on the show is Newt Gingrich, who has given money to one of the people who he had on the show. So the policy, as stated by CNN now, is that if a Crossfire co-host has made a financial contribution to a politician who appears on the program or is the focus of the program, disclosure is not required during the show since the co-host's political support is obvious by his or her point of view as expressed on the program. I'd love to hear your reaction to that.
Well, I think there has to be real walls between even conservative commentators and conservative politicians. And the same on the other side, on the liberal side. I think there has to be walls. You shouldn't benefit from someone else's election. You shouldn't have a deal with them where you can have an opinion that you share with them and you can sympathize with them and say so on the air. That's what a commentator does. But you shouldn't benefit if they win. You shouldn't have an investment in their winning. I think that's where you draw the line. That's where I would draw it. I think they're wrong not to draw that line. I think people who've invested in someone winning will benefit either through patronage or favoritism or something. Anybody knows this. You give money to somebody, you're part of their team. And I think that you can agree with him. I mean, Peggy and I have talked about this. People in the White House, when she was writing outside Peggy Noonan, when she wrote about George Bush, they thought, oh, you're on the team. No, no. I agree with you on this stuff. That's why I'm saying it, not because I'm on your team. I happen to agree with you. And that's my view with Obama. When I agree with him most of the time, I agree with you. I'm not on your team, but I agree with you. That distinction has to be made and kept. Just like, for example, at NBC and on MSNBC, we can't give a speech for money and not give it all, every nickel of it, to charity. And you just can't do it, because if you start taking money from a health group or whatever, you are part of their team. And they may never call on you, but it looks like it. It looks like they can. And that's why you have to draw these lines. And I think it's very appropriate what our network does. It's tough. There's money to be had out there, but it's better that it goes to charity than to your pocket, because at that point, you become invested, I think.
So I don't.
I think people expect this, by the way. And I really think, why would you keep it secret? That would be my question. And that gets back to politicians. They always, if it looks better than it is, they'll tell you. If it looks worse, they may not. And that's why you ought to know the worst.
So
I think.
I don't mean to make a comparison between, you know, giving money to a politician and then interviewing them with what I'm going to ask now. But, you know, one thing that bothers me a little when I watch your show is when you have a new book, as you do now, you plug it a lot on your show.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, it makes me uncomfortable. I feel like...
Well, it doesn't make me uncomfortable. I want them to read the book. In fact, I'm going to...
I know you want them to read the book.
In fact, I'll ask them to read it at some point, because they watch my program. I've invested, in this case, half dozen years of my life, and more than 2 years of hard work in trying to accumulate this information and get it right through Reagan's diaries and my diaries and on-the-record reporting and verbates of press conferences. I wanted to get it right. I want them to know this history, and I want them to buy the book, and I'm going to ask them to do it. I think it's important that they read the book, just like it's important they listen to me.
But you are making money on the book, so there is a little bit of, you know...
Oh, yeah.
Using the mic.
Because I put the work in. And usually people get paid for work.
Okay. So
we disagree.
Yeah, you're not going to budge on this one.
I'm not going to budge, because I work very hard on these books. And I think that I think they're worth the time of my viewer to learn what I've learned and to benefit from it. I absolutely believe my book on Kennedy helped them. I believe everybody who read the book is better off for having read it. And they're going to be a lot better off for reading Tip and the Gipper, because it'll give them a sense of the American political norm. And it's not what we have today. The American political norm is to have the right and the left finally reach agreement in keeping the government working, because they believe in our form of government. And I want to make that case. Hold your ears, Terry, next time.
So we've established modesty.
You are so National Public Radio, because that is, see, the non-commercial aspect of your employment is probably the why you think like this. But there are people who have said that to me. I'm sure some of my producers think that way, but... I feel the same way
about O'Reilly, like when on O'Reilly's show.
Oh,
like,
he does it too, but he does
the time, yeah. And so I feel that, you know, like the same way about it.
But you don't have to watch. And they know why I'm doing it. And if they think I want people to buy my book, they're right.
I'm going to have to challenge you to a duel.
I wish we still lived in a time when I could challenge a man to a duel. That would be really great.
That was Zell Miller.
It was so scary. It was scary, because I thought he meant it. And I said to my producers
governor of Georgia then?
And then senator. He was senator.
Senator from Georgia,
And he said, I wish I was over there so I could get into your face and all this stuff. And I know he's a good guy, served in the country in the Marines. And I felt, why am I in this fight with him? And he just... was at me that night, and
it was like an election night, and he was a conservative Democrat.
I was on Broadway at 34th Street in New York, in Broadway, right next to Macy's, Miracle on 34th Street, I call it, and he was at a remote location at the convention hall, and I was just interviewing him, and he just jumped on me. But after it was over, I said to my producers, now don't build up this and don't giggle about this, because, you know, I do not want to end up on a bluff somewhere in New Jersey tomorrow morning with dueling pistols. This guy may be real.
Did you really thought he might be?
The look he had in his eye was real, yeah. It was something.
And did he
anyway,
apologize
that's the, that'll go in the reel. I've asked him, I probably should at some point sit down and write a letter saying I respect your service to the country and... but I don't think he missed it. He probably enjoyed it every inch of the way, so why take it back from him? But it was colorful, wasn't it? Memorable.
It obviously was memorable. So how much do you enjoy being on television?
Well, in the beginning of the week, Mondays, I love it. Tuesdays, I love it. Wednesdays, I like it. Thursday, I'm getting tired. Friday, it becomes work. It's all about the gung-ho energy that comes off the weekend. And I always say to people, if you want to give a speech somewhere, give it in the morning around 11. If you don't want to give a speech, don't give it at 8:30 at night after dinner. I think different times of the day you get gung-ho, and it's harder at 5 o'clock at night. It's harder at 7. It's not easy, but by the end of the week it is harder because it's that time of the day we sort of slow down. But I love it. I love being able to ask the questions and to sort of control the time and keep it moving and laugh and bring up my movies and my beliefs. And the people I get to work with, like Howard Feynman and David Korn and Joan Walsh and all the Joanne Reed and all the people I work with, I respect them enormously, E.J. Dionne and Gene Robinson. The people that are on my program regularly, I really, really like. And I really respect the reporting they do, especially people like Howard who report all the time. And I get to ask them questions. It's great.
You love politics and the political process and American government. You've always wanted to be a part of it or writing about it or talking about it. When you interview people who think government is the problem and not the solution and who want to dismantle as much as possible, defund as much as possible, what's your emotional reaction to that as somebody who, you know, just loves the political process so much?
Well, I do respect the libertarian cowboyism of I want to be self-reliant. I do think that's an American character of being on your own out there in the sagebrush and not needing anybody. But in fact, we do need people. I was fortunate to go to college. You mentioned I went to Holy Cross. I got there because of the National Defense Education Act loans. I had four brothers. My parents weren't wealthy, and all of us went to school on loans, and they were 3%. You paid for them when you got out of the Peace Corps or grad school. I got a National Defense Education Act fellowship at graduate school. My father was on the GI Bill when he came back. He was in the Navy in World War II, and we became middle class because of the GI Bill. I was in the Peace Corps. My father worked for a city government. I never thought that government wasn't a good thing. People don't. They always resist admitting it, but when most people are listening now think of what did the government ever do for me, they're going to find some surprising answers, whether their parents, usually in the area of education. And I think Social Security is a great thing. I think people, the pressures under them, they can't save a lot of money. And they need to have that bit of money that's going to guarantee that they do not end up in poverty. The greatest anti-poverty program in American history is Social Security. We always underestimate because we think the older people are getting well or getting too much. They're not. Most of them are living on Social Security, and that's it. These programs really changed America for the better. And so I think the argument is still there for people to say, you know what, stop knocking what works. And we have a system of mixed capitalism in this country, a bit more conservative than Europe or Germany or England. It's not a socialist country, but it has aspects of social democracy that we have come to like and appreciate. And I think we should be proud of the compromise we've made. And it works.
You were a young man when you worked for Tip O'Neill, and he was about 70. You're now just a few years away from Tip O'Neill's age.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it surprises you to be close to his age.
It sure does. In fact, I was kidding somebody the other day who was having a 40th birthday party, and I said, 40's the new 10. I mean, everybody is still kind of keeping going and running, and people are jogging and everything to stay youthful, and we're trying to push back time, and people look younger than they did at the same age. I do think about it all the time. Sorry, what did Grandpa look like? What did Charlie Shields look like when he was my age, 67? What did he seem like to me? And he was an old cigar-smoking neighborhood Democrat. And what was that like? What's that like? Was he really that old? I can't believe it. Am I that old? I can't believe it. So I still feel 20-something, you know, so it doesn't affect me. But I am kind of amazed when I look in the mirror sometimes. I say, I'm beginning to look more like Dad. And that's the way it is. I just thought I looked like my mom. But no, it doesn't bother me yet. I'm healthy, so I'm a very lucky guy.
Well, Chris Matthews, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry Gross, thank you.
Chris Matthews is the host of the MSNBC program Hardball and author of the new book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by bassist Dave Holland. This is Fresh Air.